The Upright Thinkers, The Human Journey from Living in Trees to Understanding the Cosmos. This is the author, Leonard Mlodinow. Part 1. The Upright Thinkers. The most beautiful and deepest experience a man can have is the sense of the mysterious. It is the underlying principle of religion, as well as of all serious endeavor in art and science. He who never had this experience seems to me, if not dead, then at least blind. Albert Einstein, My Credo, 1932. Chapter 1. Our Drive to Know. My father once told me of an emaciated fellow inmate in the Buchenwald concentration camp who had been educated in mathematics. You can tell something about people from what comes to mind when they hear the term pi. To the mathematician, it was the ratio of the circumference of a circle to its diameter. Had I asked my father, who had but a seventh grade education, he would have said it was a circle of crust filled with apples. One day, despite that gulf between them, the mathematician inmate gave my father a math puzzle to solve. My father thought about it for a few days, but could not master it. When he saw the inmate again, he asked him for the solution. The man wouldn't say, telling my father he must discover it for himself. Sometime later, my father again spoke to the man, but the man held on to his secret as if it were a hunk of gold. My father tried to ignore his curiosity, but he couldn't. Amid the stench and death around him, he became obsessed with knowing the answer. Eventually, the other inmate offered my father a deal. He would reveal the puzzle's solution if my father would hand over his crust of bread. I don't know what my father weighed at the time, but when the American forces liberated him, he weighed 85 pounds. Still, my father's need to know was so powerful that he parted with his bread in exchange for the answer. I was in my late teens when my father recounted that episode, and it made a huge impact on me. My father's family was gone, his possessions confiscated, his body starved, withered, and beaten. The Nazis had stripped him of everything palpable, yet his drive to think and reason and know survived. He was imprisoned, but his mind was free to roam, and it did. I realized then that the search for knowledge is the most human of all our desires, and that, different as our circumstances were, my own passion for understanding the world was driven by the same instinct as my father's. As I went on to study science in college and after, my father would question me, not so much about the technicalities of what I was learning, but about the underlying meaning, where the theories came from, why I felt they were beautiful, and what they said about us as human beings. This book, written decades later, is my attempt, finally, to answer those questions. A few million years ago, we humans began to stand upright, altering our muscles and skeletons so that we could walk in an erect posture, which freed our hands to probe and manipulate the objects around us, and extended the range of our gaze so that we could explore the far distance. But as we raised our stance, so too did our minds rise above those of other animals, allowing us to explore the world, not just through eyesight, but with our thoughts. We stand upright, but above all, we are thinkers. The nobility of the human race lies in our drive to know, and our uniqueness as a species is reflected in the success we've achieved, after millennia of effort, in deciphering the puzzle that is nature. An ancient, given a microwave oven to heat his auroch meat, might have theorized that inside it was an army of hard-working, pea-sized gods who built miniature bonfires under the food, then miraculously disappeared when the door was open. But just as miraculous is the truth that a handful of simple and inviolable abstract laws account for everything in our universe, from the workings of that microwave to the natural wonders of the world around us. As our understanding of the natural world evolved, we progressed from perceiving the tides as being governed by a goddess to understanding them as the result of the gravitational pull of the moon, and we graduated from thinking of the stars as gods floating in the heavens to identifying them as nuclear furnaces that send photons our way. Today, we understand the inner workings of our sun 100 million miles away, and the structure of an atom more than a billion times smaller than ourselves. That we have been able to decode these and other natural phenomena is not just a marvel. It also makes a gripping tale, and an epic one. Some time ago, I spent a season on the writing staff of the television series Star Trek: The Next Generation. At my first story meeting there, at a table populated by all the show's other writers and producers, I pitched an idea for an episode that excited me because it involved the real astrophysics of solar wind. All eyes were focused on me, the new guy, the physicist in their midst, as I enthusiastically detailed my idea and the science behind it. When I was done, the pitch had taken less than a minute, I looked with great pride and satisfaction at my boss, a gruff, middle-aged producer who had once been an NYPD homicide detective. He stared at me for a moment, his face strangely unreadable, and then he said with great force, "Shut up, you effing egghead!" When I got over my embarrassment, I realized that what he was so succinctly telling me was that they had hired me for my storytelling abilities, not to conduct an extension school class on the physics of stars. His point was well taken, and I have let it guide my writing ever since. In the wrong hands, science can be famously boring. But the story of what we know and how we know it isn't boring at all. It is supremely exciting. Full of episodes of discovery that are no less compelling than the Star Trek episode or our first trip to the moon, it is peopled by characters as passionate and quirky as those we know from art and music and literature. Seekers whose insatiable curiosity took our species from its origin on the African savanna to the society we live in today. How did they do that? How did we go from a species that had barely learned to walk upright and lived off whatever nuts and berries and roots we could harvest with our bare hands, to one that flies airplanes, sends messages instantly around the globe, and recreates in enormous laboratories the conditions of the early universe? That is the story I want to tell, for to know it is to understand your heritage as a human being. It has become a cliché to say that the world is flat. But if the distances and differences between countries are effectively diminishing, the differences between today and tomorrow are growing. When the first cities were built, around 4000 BC, the fastest way to travel long distances was by camel caravan, which averaged just a few miles per hour. Somewhere between 1000 and 2000 years later, the chariot was invented, raising the maximum speed to about 20 miles per hour. Not until the 19th century did the steam locomotive finally allow faster travel, reaching speeds up to 100 miles per hour by the century's end. But although it took humans 2 million years to graduate from running 10 miles per hour to racing across the country at 100 miles per hour, it took only 50 years to achieve the next factor of 10, with the creation of an airplane that could fly 1,000 miles an hour. And by the 1980s, humans were traveling at more than 17,000 miles per hour in the space shuttle. The evolution of other technologies exhibits a similar acceleration. Take communications. As late as the 19th century, the Reuters news service was still using carrier pigeons to fly stock prices between cities. Then, by the mid-19th century, the telegraph had become available, and in the 20th century, the telephone. But while it took 81 years for the landline telephone to achieve a market penetration of 75%, the cell phone achieved that in 28 years, and the smartphone in 13. In recent years, first email and then texting largely supplanted phone calls as a tool for communication, while the phone is increasingly employed not for phone calls, but as a pocket computer. "The world of today," said economist Kenneth Boulding, "is as different from the world in which I was born as that world was from Julius Caesar's." Boulding was born in 1910 and died in 1993. The changes he witnessed, and many others that have occurred since, were the products of science and the technology it spawns. Such changes are a greater part of human life than ever before, and our success at work and in society is increasingly predicated on our ability to both assimilate innovation and to create innovations ourselves. For today, even those of us who don't work in science and technology face challenges that require us to innovate if we are to remain competitive. And so the nature of discovery is an important topic for us all. To gain perspective on where we are today and to have a hope of understanding where we are going, one must know where we came from. The greatest triumphs of human intellectual history, writing and mathematics, natural philosophy, and the various sciences, are usually presented in isolation, as if each had nothing to do with the others. But that approach emphasizes the trees and not the forest. It neglects, by its very nature, the unity of human knowledge. The development of modern science, for example, often heralded as the work of isolated geniuses, such as Galileo and Newton, did not spring from a social or cultural vacuum. It had its roots in the approach to knowledge invented by the ancient Greeks. It grew from the big questions posed by religion. It developed hand in hand with a new approach to art. It was colored by the lessons of alchemy, and it would have been impossible without social progress, ranging from the grand development of the great universities of Europe to mundane inventions, such as that of the postal systems that grew to connect nearby cities and countries. The Greek Enlightenment, similarly, sprouted from the astounding intellectual inventions of earlier peoples in lands such as Mesopotamia and Egypt. As a result of such influences and connections, the account of how humans came to understand the cosmos does not consist of isolated vignettes. It forms, like the best fiction, a coherent narrative, a unified whole, whose parts have numerous interconnections, and which begins at the dawn of humanity. In what follows, I offer a selective, guided tour of that odyssey of discovery. Our tour begins with the development of the modern human mind and features the critical eras and turning points at which that mind leapt to new ways of looking at the world. Along the way, I also portray some of the fascinating characters whose unique personal qualities and modes of thought played an important role in those innovations. Like many tales, this is a drama in three parts. Part one, spanning millions of years, traces the evolution of the human brain and its propensity to ask why. Our whys propelled us to our earliest spiritual inquiries and led, eventually, to the development of writing and mathematics and the very concept of laws, the necessary tools of science. Ultimately, those whys led to the invention of philosophy, the insight that the material world operates according to rhyme and reason that can, in principle, be understood. The next phase of our journey explores the birth of the hard sciences. It is the story of revolutionaries who had the gift of seeing the world differently and the patience, grit, brilliance, and courage to continue striving through all the years and even decades it sometimes took to develop their ideas. These pioneers, thinkers such as Galileo, Newton, Lavoisier, and Darwin, fought long and hard against the established doctrine of their day, so their stories are inevitably tales of personal struggle, sometimes with stakes as high as life itself. Finally, as in many good stories, our tale takes an unexpected turn just when its heroes have reason to think that they're close to the end of their journey. For no sooner did humanity come to believe it had deciphered all the laws of nature than, in a strange twist of the plot, such thinkers as Einstein, Bohr, and Heisenberg discovered a new realm of existence, an invisible one, in which those laws had to be rewritten. That other world, with its otherworldly laws, plays out on a scale too small to be apprehended directly, the microcosmos of the atom, ruled by the laws of quantum physics. It is those laws that are responsible for the enormous and still accelerating changes that we are experiencing in society today, for it is our understanding of the quantum that enabled the invention of computers, cell phones, televisions, lasers, the internet, medical imaging, genetic mapping, and most of the new technologies that have revolutionized modern life. While part one of the book covers millions of years and part two covers hundreds, part three spans mere decades, reflecting the exponential acceleration in the accumulation of human knowledge and the newness of our forays into this strange new world. The odyssey of human discovery stretches over many eras, but the themes of our quest to understand the world never vary, as they arise from our own human nature. One theme is familiar to anyone who works in a field dedicated to innovation and discovery. The difficulty of conceiving of a world, or an idea, that is any different from the world or ideas that we already know. In the 1950s, Isaac Asimov, one of the greatest and most creative science fiction writers of all time, wrote the Foundation Trilogy, a series of novels set many thousands of years in the future. In those books, the men commute to work in offices every day, and the women stay home. Within only a few decades, that vision of the distant future was already a thing of the past. I bring this up because it illustrates an almost universal limitation of human thought. Our creativity is constrained by conventional thinking that arises from beliefs we can't shake or never even think of questioning. The flip side of the difficulty of conceiving change is the difficulty of accepting it, and that is another recurring theme of our story. We human beings can find change overwhelming. Change makes demands on our minds, takes us beyond our comfort zones, shatters our mental habits. It produces confusion and disorientation. It requires that we let go of old ways of thinking, and the letting go is not our choice, but is imposed upon us. What's more, the changes resulting from scientific progress often upend belief systems to which large numbers of people, and possibly their careers and their livelihoods, are attached. As a result, new ideas in science are often met with resistance, anger, and ridicule. Science is the soul of modern technology, the root of modern civilization. It underpins many of the political, religious, and ethical issues of our day, and the ideas that underlie it are transforming society at an ever faster pace. But just as science plays a key role in shaping the patterns of human thought, it is also true that the patterns of human thinking have played a key role in shaping our theories of science. For science is, as Einstein remarked, as subjective and psychologically conditioned as any other branch of human endeavor. This book is an effort to describe the development of science in that spirit, as an intellectual as well as a culturally determined enterprise, whose ideas can best be understood by an examination of the personal, psychological, historical, and social situations that molded them. To look at science that way sheds light not just on the enterprise itself, but on the nature of human creativity and innovation, and more broadly, on the human condition. Chapter 2. Curiosity. To understand the roots of science, we must look back to the roots of the human species itself. We humans are uniquely endowed with both the capacity and the desire to understand ourselves and the world. That is the greatest of the gifts that set us apart from other animals, and it is why it is we who study mice and guinea pigs, and not they who study us. The urge to know, to ponder, and to create, exercised through thousands of millennia, has provided us with the tools to survive, to build for ourselves a unique ecological niche. Using the power of our intellect rather than our physique, we have shaped our environment to our needs, rather than allowing our environment to shape or to defeat us. Over millions of years, the force and creativity of our minds have triumphed over the obstacles that challenged the strength and agility of our bodies. When he was young, my son Nikolai used to like to capture small lizards to keep as pets, something you can do when you live in Southern California. We noticed that when we approached the animals, they would first freeze, and then, as we reached down for them, they would flee. We eventually figured out that if we brought along a large box, we could invert it over a lizard before it scurried off, and then we could slide a piece of cardboard under it to complete the capture. Personally, if I'm walking down a dark, deserted street and see anything suspicious going on, I don't freeze, I immediately cross to the other side. So it's pretty safe to assume that if I were approached by two giant predators heading toward me, staring eagerly and carrying a gargantuan box, I'd assume the worst and instantly race away. Lizards, though, don't question their situation. They act purely by instinct. That instinct no doubt served them well over the many millions of years that preceded Nikolai in the box, but it failed them here. We humans may not be the ultimate in physical specimens, but we do have the ability to supplement instinct with reason, and, most important for our purposes, to ask questions about our environment. Those are the prerequisites of scientific thought, and they are crucial characteristics of our species. And so that is where our adventure begins, with the development of the human brain, with its unique gifts. We call ourselves the human species, but the word human actually refers not only to us, Homo sapiens sapiens, but to an entire genus called Homo. This genus includes other species, such as Homo habilis and Homo erectus, but those relatives are all long gone. In the single elimination tournament called evolution, all the other human species proved inadequate. Only we, due to the power of our minds, have met all survival challenges, at least thus far. Not too long ago, the man who was then the president of Iran was quoted as saying that Jews descended from monkeys and pigs. It is always heartening when a fundamentalist of any religion professes a belief in evolution, so I hesitate to criticize. But actually, Jews, and all other humans too, are descended not from monkeys and pigs, but from apes and rats, or at least rat-like creatures. Called Protungulatum Danae in the scientific literature, our great-great-great and so on grandmother, the progenitor of our ancestral primates and of all mammals like us, seems to have been a cute furry-tailed species whose members weighed in at no more than half a pound. Scientists believe that these tiny animals first scurried across their habitat around 66 million years ago, soon after a 6-mile-wide asteroid slammed into the Earth. That catastrophic collision threw enough debris into the atmosphere to choke off the sun's rays for an extended period of time and generated enough greenhouse gases to send temperatures soaring once the dust had settled. The double whammy of darkness followed by heat killed off about 75% of all plant and animal species. But for us, it was fortunate. It created an ecological niche in which animals that give birth to live young could survive and even thrive without being gobbled up by ravenous dinosaurs and other predators. Over the subsequent tens of millions of years, as species after species emerged and then faded into extinction, one branch of the Protungulatum family tree evolved into our ape and monkey ancestors, and then it branched further, producing our closest living relatives, the chimpanzees and bonobos, and finally you, the listener of this audiobook, and your fellow humans. Today, most people are comfortable with the fact that Grandma had a tail and ate insects. I go further than mere acceptance. I am excited and fascinated by our ancestry and the story of our survival and our cultural evolution. I think the fact that our ancient grandparents were rats and apes is one of the coolest facts about nature. On our amazing planet, a rat, plus 66 million years, yielded scientists who study the rat and thus discover their own roots. Along the way, we developed culture and history and religion and science, and we replaced our ancestors' nests of twigs with gleaming skyscrapers of concrete and steel. The speed of this intellectual development has been increasing dramatically. Nature required about 60 million years to produce the ape from which all humans descended. The rest of our physical evolution occurred in a few million. Our cultural evolution has taken only about 10,000. It is as if, in the words of psychologist Julian Jaynes, all life evolved to a certain point, and then in ourselves turned at a right angle and simply exploded in a different direction. Animal brains first evolved for the most primal of reasons, to better enable motion. The ability to move, to find food and shelter, and to escape from enemies is, of course, one of the most fundamental characteristics of animals. Looking backward along the road of evolution to animals such as nematodes, earthworms, and mollusks, we find that the earliest brain-like precursors functioned to control motion by exciting muscles in the right order. But movement does little good without the ability to perceive the environment, and so even simple animals have a way to sense what is around them, cells that react to certain chemicals, for example, or to photons of light, by sending electrical impulses to the nerves governing motion control. By the time Protungulatum danae appeared, these chemical and photosensitive cells had evolved into senses of smell and sight, and the nexus of nerves that controlled muscle movement had become a brain. No one knows exactly how our ancestors' brains were organized into functional components. But even in the modern human brain, far more than half the neurons are devoted to motor control and the five senses. That part of our brain that sets us apart from lower animals, on the other hand, is relatively small and was late in coming. One of the first nearly human creatures roamed the Earth just 3 to 4 million years ago. It was unknown to us until one blistering day in 1974, when an anthropologist named Donald Johansson from Berkeley's Institute of Human Origins stumbled across a tiny fragment of an arm bone sticking out of the scorched terrain in a parched ravine in remote northern Ethiopia. Johansson and a student soon dug up more bones, thigh and rib bones, vertebrae, even a partial jawbone. All told, they found nearly half the skeleton of a female. She had a woman's pelvis, a small skull, short legs, and long, dangling arms. Not someone you'd ask to the prom, but this 3.2-million-year-old lady is thought to be a link to our past, a transitional species, and possibly the ancestor from which our entire genus evolved. Johansson named the new species Australopithecus afarensis, which means southern ape of Afar, Afar being the region of Ethiopia in which he made his discovery. He also named the bones Lucy, after the Beatles song Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds, which was playing on the camp radio as Johansson and his team celebrated. Andy Warhol said everyone gets 15 minutes of fame, and after millions of years, this woman finally got hers. Or to be more accurate, half of her did. Her other half was never found. It is surprising how much anthropologists can discern from half a skeleton. Lucy's large teeth, with jaws adapted for crushing, suggest that she had a vegetarian diet consisting of tough roots, seeds, and fruit with hard outer coverings. Her skeletal structure indicates that she had a huge belly, which would have been necessary to hold the great length of intestine she'd have needed in order to digest the quantity of vegetable matter she required to survive. Most important, the structure of her spine and knees indicates that she walked more or less upright, and a bone from a member of her species that Johansson and his colleagues discovered nearby in 2011 reveals a human-like foot with arches suited to walking as opposed to gripping branches. Lucy's species had evolved from a life up in the trees to a life on the ground, enabling its members to forage through the mixed ecology of forest and grassland and to exploit new ground-based food sources such as protein-rich roots and tubers. It was a style of living that many believe spawned the entire Homo genus. Imagine living in a house and having your mother live next door, her mother next door to her, and so on. Our human heritage is not actually that linear, but complexities aside, it is interesting to imagine driving along that street, traveling back in time, and passing generation after generation of ancestors. If you did that, you'd have to drive almost 4,000 miles to reach the home of Lucy, who, as a 3'7", 65-pound hairy woman, would look more like a chimp to you than a relative. About halfway there, you'd have passed the home of an ancestor who was 100,000 generations removed from Lucy, the first species similar enough to people today, in skeleton and, scientists theorize, in mind, to be classed in the genus Homo. Scientists have dubbed that 2-million-year-old species of human Homo habilis, or handyman. Homo habilis lived on the immense African savannas at a time when, due to climatic change, the forests were receding. Those grassy plains were not an easy environment, for they served as a home to an enormous number of terrifying predators. The less dangerous of the predators competed with Homo habilis for their dinner. The more dangerous tried to make them dinner. One way the handy men survived was through their wits. They had a new larger brain, the size of a small grapefruit. On the fruit salad scale of brain heft, that is smaller than our cantaloupe, but twice the volume of Lucy's orange. When comparing different species, we know from experience that there is usually a rough correlation between intellectual capability and average brain weight relative to body size. Hence, from his brain size, we can conclude that Handyman was an intellectual improvement over Lucy and her kind. Luckily, we can gauge brain size and shape in humans and other primates, even if their species is long extinct, because their brains fit snugly into their skulls, which means that if we find a primate skull, we in essence have a cast of the brain that once occupied it. Lest I appear to be advocating hat size as a proxy for intelligence testing, I should add the disclaimer that when scientists speak of being able to gauge intelligence by comparing brain size, they are talking only about making comparisons between the average brain sizes of different species. Brain size varies considerably among the individuals of a species, but within a species, brain size is not directly related to intelligence. For example, modern human brains average about 3 pounds. Yet the brain of the English poet Lord Byron weighed in at about 5 pounds, while that of the French writer and Nobel Prize winner Anatole France weighed just a bit more than 2, and Einstein's brain weighed about 2.7. And then there is the case of a man named Daniel Lyons, who died in 1907 at age 41. He had a normal body weight and normal intelligence, but when his brain was weighed at his autopsy, it was found to tip the scale at a mere 680 grams, about a pound and a half. The moral of the story is that within a species, the architecture of the brain, the nature of the connections among neurons and groups of neurons, is far more important than the size of the brain. Lucy's brain was only slightly larger than that of a chimp. More important, the shape of her skull indicates that the increased brain power was concentrated in regions of the brain that deal with sensory processing, while the frontal, temporal, and parietal lobes, the regions of the brain in which abstract reasoning and language are seated, remained relatively undeveloped. Lucy was a step toward the Homo genus, but not yet there. That changed with Handyman. Like Lucy, Handyman stood upright, freeing his hands to carry things, but unlike Lucy, Handyman used that freedom to experiment with his environment. And so it happened that roughly 2 million years ago, a Homo habilis Einstein, or a Madame Curie, or, perhaps more likely, several ancient geniuses working independently of one another, made humankind's first momentous discovery. If you smash one stone into another at an oblique angle, you can flake off a sharp, knife-edged shard of rock. Learning to bash one rock against another doesn't sound like the beginning of a social and cultural revolution. Certainly, producing a shard of stone pales in comparison with inventing the light bulb, the internet, or chocolate chip cookies. But it was our first baby step toward the realization that we could learn about and transform nature to improve our existence, and that we could rely on our brains to bestow us with powers that complemented and often exceeded those of our bodies. To a creature who has never seen a tool of any sort, a kind of jumbo artificial tooth you could grasp in your hand and use for cutting and chopping is a life-changing invention, and it did help to change completely the way humans live. Lucy and her kind were vegetarians. Microscopic studies of the wear and tear on Homo habilis teeth and butchering marks on bones found near their skeletons indicate that handymen had used their stone cutters to add meat to their diet. Being a vegetarian had exposed Lucy and her species to seasonal shortages of plant food. Having a mixed diet helped Homo habilis bridge those shortages. And because meat is a more concentrated form of nutrients than vegetable matter, meat eaters required a smaller quantity of food than vegetarians. On the other hand, you don't have to chase down and slaughter a head of broccoli, while procuring animal matter can be quite difficult if you don't have lethal weapons, which handymen lacked. As a result, the handymen obtained most of their meat from carcasses left behind by predators like saber-toothed tigers, which with their powerful front paws and butcher knife teeth, killed prey that were often far larger than what they could consume themselves. But even scavenging can be difficult if, like the handymen, you have to compete with other species. So next time you fret about the half-hour wait for a seat in your favorite restaurant, try to remember that, to obtain their food, your ancestors had to battle wandering packs of fierce hyenas. In their struggle to procure food, handymen's sharp stones would have made the task of ripping stray flesh off the bone faster and easier, helping to level the playing field with animals who'd been born with the equivalent tools. So once these implements appeared, they became enormously popular, and they remained the human tool of choice for nearly 2 million years. In fact, it was just such a scattering of stones found alongside fossils of Homo habilis that inspired the name Handyman, bestowed on the species by Louis Leakey and his colleagues in the early 1960s. Since then, the stone choppers have been found to be so abundant at excavation sites that you often have to tread carefully if you don't want to step on one. It is a long journey from sharp stones to liver transplants. But, as reflected by his tool use, Homo habilis' mind had already advanced beyond the capabilities of any of our extant primate relatives. For example, even after years of training by primate researchers, bonobos failed to become proficient in the use of simple stone tools of the type employed by Homo habilis. Recent neuroimaging studies suggest that this ability to design, plan, and use tools arose from the evolutionary development of a specialized tool use network in our left brain. Sadly, there are rare cases in which humans with damage to that network do no better than bonobos. They can identify tools, but, like me before coffee, they can't figure out how to employ even simple devices such as a toothbrush or comb. Despite the improved cognitive power, this more than 2 million-year-old species of human, Homo habilis, is but a shadow of the modern human, still relatively small-brained and also physically small, with long arms and a face only a zookeeper could love. But after its appearance, it didn't take long, on geological timescales, for several other Homo species to emerge. The most important of those, the one that most experts agree was the direct ancestor of our own species, was Homo erectus, or erect man, which originated in Africa about 1.8 million years ago. Skeletal remains reveal erect man as a species that bore a far greater resemblance to our present-day species than did handyman, not just more erect, but bigger and taller, nearly 5 feet in stature, with long limbs and a much larger skull, which allowed for expansion of the frontal, temporal, and parietal lobes of the brain. That new, larger skull had implications for the birthing process. One thing car makers don't have to contend with when redesigning one of their models is how to get the new Hondas to squeeze out the tailpipe of the older Hondas. But nature does have to worry about such things, and so in the case of Homo erectus, the head redesign caused some issues. Homo erectus females had to be larger than their predecessors in order to birth their big-headed, large-brained babies. As a result, while a Homo habilis female was only 60% as large as her male counterpart, the average Homo erectus woman weighed 85% as much as her mate. The new brains were worth the cost, for erect man marked another abrupt and magnificent shift in human evolution. They saw the world and approached its challenges differently than their predecessors had. In particular, they were the first humans to have the imaginative and planning skills to create complex stone and wooden tools. Carefully crafted hand axes, knives, and cleavers that required other tools for their construction. Today we credit our brains with giving us the ability to create science and technology, art and literature. But our brains' ability to conceive of complex tools was far more important to our species. It gave us an edge that aided our very survival. With their advanced tools, erect man could hunt and not just scavenge, increasing the availability of meat in their diet. If the veal recipes in modern cookbooks began by saying, "Hunt down and slaughter a calf," most people would stick to recipes in books like The Joys of Eggplant. But in the history of human evolution, the new ability to hunt was a giant leap forward, allowing greater consumption of protein and less dependence on the high volumes of plant food previously necessary for survival. Erect man was probably also the first species to learn that rubbing materials together creates heat, and to discover that heat creates fire. With fire, erect man could do what no other animal is capable of. Stay warm in climates that would otherwise have been too cold to sustain its life. I find it somehow comforting that while I do my hunting at the butcher counter and my idea of tool use is to call a carpenter, I hail from folks who are quite adept at the practical, even if they did have protruding foreheads and teeth that could gnaw through a yardstick. More important, these new achievements of the mind enabled Homo erectus to branch out from Africa to Europe and Asia, and to persist as a species for well over 1 million years. If advances in our intelligence allowed us to make complex hunting and butchering tools, they also created a new pressing need. for chasing down and cornering a large fast animal on the savannah is best done by a team of hunters. And so, long before we humans formed all-star basketball and soccer teams, there was evolutionary pressure for our genus to evolve enough social intelligence and planning skill to cohere and band together to score antelopes and gazelles. Erect man's new lifestyle therefore favored the survival of those who could best communicate and plan. Here again, we see the origins of modern human nature rooted in the African savanna. Somewhere toward the end of erect man's reign, perhaps half a million years ago, Homo erectus evolved into a new form, Homo sapiens, with even greater cerebral power. Those early, or archaic, Homo sapiens were still not beings we would recognize as present-day humans. They had more robust bodies and larger and thicker skulls, but brains that were still not quite as large as ours today. Anatomically modern humans are classified as a subspecies of Homo sapiens that probably didn't emerge from early Homo sapiens until around 200,000 BC. We almost didn't make it. An amazing recent analysis of DNA by genetic anthropologists indicates that sometime around 140,000 years ago, a catastrophic event, probably related to climate change, decimated the ranks of modern humans, all of whom then lived in Africa. During that period, the entire population of our subspecies plummeted to just several hundred, making us what we would today call an endangered species, like the mountain gorilla or the blue whale. Isaac Newton, Albert Einstein, and everyone else you've ever heard of, and the billions of us who live in the world today, are all descendants of those mere hundreds who survived. That close call was perhaps an indication that the new subspecies with the larger brain still wasn't quite smart enough to make it in the long run. But then we underwent another transformation, one that gave us astonishing new mental powers. It does not seem to have been due to a change in our physical anatomy, not even in the anatomy of our brain. Instead, it seems to have been a reworking of how our brain operates. However it happened, it was that metamorphosis that enabled our species to produce scientists, artists, theologians, and more generally, people who think the way we do. Anthropologists refer to that final mental transformation as the development of modern human behavior. By modern behavior, they don't mean shopping or gulping intoxicating beverages while watching sports competitions. They mean the exercise of complex symbolic thought, the kind of mental activity that would eventually lead to our current human culture. There is some controversy about just when that happened, but the most generally accepted date puts the transition at around 40,000 BC. Today we call our subspecies Homo sapiens sapiens, or wise wise man. Your own species ends up with a name like that when you get to choose it yourself. But all the changes that led to our large brains didn't come cheap. From the point of view of energy consumption, the modern human brain is the second most expensive organ in the body, after the heart. Rather than endowing us with brains that have such high operating costs, nature could have bestowed upon us more powerful muscles, which, compared with the brain, consume just one-tenth the calories per unit mass. Yet nature chose not to make our species the most physically fit. We humans are not particularly strong, nor are we the most agile. Our nearest relatives, the chimpanzee and the bonobo, savaged their way into their ecological niche through their ability to pull with a force exceeding 1,200 pounds, and by having teeth so sharp and rugged, they tear with ease through hard nutshells. I, on the other hand, have trouble with popcorn. Rather than impressive muscle mass, humans have oversized craniums, making us inefficient users of food energy. Our brains, which account for only about 2% of our body weight, consume about 20% of our calorie intake. So while other animals are adept at surviving the harshness of the jungle or the savanna, we seem more suited to sitting in a cafe, sipping mochas. That sitting, though, is not to be underestimated. For as we sit, we think, and we question. In 1918, German psychologist Wolfgang Kurler published a book destined to become a classic called The Mentality of Apes. It was an account of experiments he had conducted on chimpanzees while he was director of a Prussian Academy of Sciences outpost on Tenerife in the Canary Islands. Kurler was interested in understanding the way chimpanzees solve problems, such as how to procure food that has been placed out of reach. And his experiments reveal much about the mental gifts we share with other primates. But if one contrasts chimpanzee behavior with our own, his book also reveals much about the human talents that help compensate for our physical shortcomings. One of Kurler's experiments was especially telling. He nailed a banana to the ceiling and noted that the chimpanzees could learn to stack boxes in order to climb up and get it, but they seemed to have no knowledge of the forces involved. For example, they would sometimes try to stack a box on its edge, or if stones were placed on the floor so that the boxes toppled over, they would not think to remove the stones. In an updated version of the experiment, chimps and human children, aged 3 to 5, were taught to stack L-shaped blocks to obtain a reward. Then weighted blocks were surreptitiously substituted for the originals. These toppled over when the chimps and children tried to stack them. The chimps persisted for a while, employing trial and error in failed attempts to earn the reward, but they did not pause to examine the off-balance blocks. The human children also failed the revised task. It actually wasn't achievable, but they did not simply give up. They examined the blocks in an attempt to determine what the problem was. From an early age, we humans seek answers. We seek a theoretical understanding of our environment. We ask the question, why? Anyone who has experience with young children knows their love of the why question. In the 1920s, psychologist Frank Lorimer made it official. He observed a 4-year-old boy over a period of 4 days and scribbled down all the whys the child asked during that time. There were 40 of them, questions such as, why does the watering pot have 2 handles? Why do we have eyebrows? And my favorite, why don't you have a beard, mother? Human children all over the world ask their first questions at an early age while they are still babbling and don't yet speak grammatical language. The act of questioning is so important to our species that we have a universal indicator for it. All languages, whether tonal or non-tonal, exhibit a similar rising intonation for questions. Certain religious traditions see questioning as the highest form of apprehension, and in both science and industry, the ability to ask the right questions is probably the greatest talent one can have. Chimpanzees and bonobos, on the other hand, can learn to use rudimentary signing to communicate with their trainers and even to answer questions, but they never ask them. They are physically powerful, but they are not thinkers. If we humans are born with a drive to understand our environment, we also seem to be born with, or at least acquire at a very early age, a gut feeling regarding how the laws of physics operate. We seem to innately understand that all events are caused by other events, and to have a rudimentary intuition for the laws that, after millennia of effort, were eventually uncovered by Isaac Newton. In the Infant Cognition Laboratory at the University of Illinois, scientists have spent the past 30 years studying the physical intuition of babies by sitting mothers and their children at a small stage or table and observing how the infants react to staged events. The scientific question at hand? With regard to the physical world, what do these infants know, and when did they know it? What they have discovered is that possessing a certain feeling for the workings of physics seems to be an essential aspect of what it means to be human, even in infancy. In one series of studies, 6-month-olds sat in front of a horizontal track that was attached to an inclined ramp. At the bottom of the ramp, researchers had placed a toy bug mounted on wheels. At the top of the ramp was a cylinder. Once the cylinder was let loose, the infants watched excitedly as it rolled downward, crashed into the bug, and sent it rolling halfway along the horizontal track, for a distance of a couple feet. Next came the part that excited the researchers. If they reproduced the setup with a different size cylinder atop the ramp, would the infants predict that, upon collision, the bug would be sent a distance that was proportional to the cylinder's size? The first question that came to mind when I heard of this experiment was, how does one know what an infant is predicting? Personally, I have trouble understanding what my kids are thinking, and being in their teens and 20s, they are all capable of speech. Did I have any insight at all, back when they were limited to smiles, grimaces, and drooling? The truth is, if you hang around babies enough, you do start attributing thoughts to them based on their facial expressions, but it is difficult to confirm scientifically whether your intuition is correct. If you see a baby's face crinkle up like a prune, is that due to severe gas pains or dismay because the radio just said the stock market tumbled 500 points? I know my own expression would look the same either way, and with babies, the look is all we have to go by. When it comes to determining what a baby is predicting, though, psychologists have an app for that. They show the baby some chain of events and then measure how long the infant gazes at the scene. If events don't unfold in the way the baby expected, the baby will stare, and the more surprising the occurrence, the longer the stare. In the RAP experiment, psychologists arranged for half the infants to watch a second collision in which the rolling cylinder was larger than before, while the others watched a second collision in which the cylinder was smaller. In both cases, however, the tricky researchers had arranged artificially that the bug would be sent rolling farther than in the first collision, all the way, in fact, to the end of the track. The infants who watched the larger cylinder send the bug farther had no exceptional reaction to the events. But sure enough, the infants who saw the bug go farther when struck by a smaller cylinder stared at the bug for a prolonged period, giving the impression they'd be scratching their heads if only they knew how. To know that big impacts will send bugs rolling farther than small impacts does not quite make you a peer of Isaac Newton, but as this experiment illustrates, humans do seem to have a certain built-in understanding of the physical world, a sophisticated intuitive feeling for the environment that complements our built-in curiosity and is far more developed in humans than in other species. Over millions of years, our species evolved and progressed, gaining a more powerful brain, striving as individuals to learn what we could about the world. The development of the modern human mind was a necessary development if we were to understand nature, but it was not sufficient. And so the next chapter in our story is the tale of how we began to ask questions about our surroundings and to band together intellectually to answer them. It is the tale of the development of human culture. Chapter 3. Culture. Those of us who look in the mirror each morning see something that few other animals ever recognize: ourselves. Some of us smile at our image and blow ourselves a kiss. Others rush to cover the disaster with makeup or to shave lest we appear unkempt. Either way, as animals go, the human reaction is an odd one. We have it because somewhere along the path of evolution, we humans became self-aware. Even more important, we began to have a clear understanding that the face we see in reflections will in time grow wrinkles, sprout hair in embarrassing places, and worst of all, cease to exist. That is, we had our first intimations of mortality. Our brain is our mental hardware, and it was for purposes of survival that we developed one with the capacity to think symbolically and to question and reason. But hardware, once you have it, can be put to many uses, and as our Homo sapiens sapiens imagination leapt forward, the realization that we will all die helped turn our brains towards existential questions such as, who is in charge of the cosmos? This is not a scientific question per se, yet the road to questions like, what is an atom, began with such queries, as well as with more personal ones like, who am I, and can I alter my environment to suit me? It is when we humans rose above our animal origins and began to make these inquiries that we took our next step forward as a species whose trademark is to think and to question. The change in human thought processes that led us to consider these issues probably simmered for tens of thousands of years, beginning around the time, probably 40,000 years ago or thereabouts, when our subspecies began to manifest what we think of as modern behaviors. But it didn't boil over until about 12,000 years ago, around the end of the last ice age. Scientists call the 2 million years leading up to that period the Paleolithic era, and the following 7 or 8,000 years, the Neolithic era. The names come from the Greek words paleo, meaning old, neo, meaning new, and lithos, meaning stone. In other words, the Old Stone Age, Paleolithic, and the New Stone Age, Neolithic, both of which were characterized by the use of stone tools. Though we call the sweeping change that took us from the Old to the New Stone Age the Neolithic Revolution, it wasn't about stone tools. It was about the way we think, the questions we ask, and the issues of existence that we consider important. Paleolithic humans migrated often, and like my teenagers, they followed the food. The women gathered plants, seeds, and eggs, while the men generally hunted and scavenged. These nomads moved seasonally, or even daily, keeping few possessions, chasing the flow of nature's bounty, enduring her hardships, and living always at her mercy. Even so, the abundance of the land was sufficient to support only about one person per square mile. So for most of the Paleolithic era, people lived in small wandering groups, usually numbering fewer than 100 individuals. The term Neolithic Revolution was coined in the 1920s to describe the transition from that lifestyle to a new existence in which humans began to settle into small villages consisting of one or two dozen dwellings and to shift from gathering food to producing it. With that shift came a movement toward actively shaping the environment rather than merely reacting to it. Instead of simply living off the bounty nature laid before them, the people living in these small settlements now collected materials with no intrinsic worth in their raw form and remade them into items of value. For example, they built homes from wood, mud brick, and stone, forged tools from naturally occurring metallic copper, wove twigs into baskets, twisted fibers gleaned from flax and other plants and animals into threads, and then wove those threads into clothing that was lighter, more porous, and more easily cleaned than the animal hides people had formerly worn, and formed and fired clay into pots and pitchers that could be used for cooking or storing surplus food products. At face value, the invention of objects like clay pitchers seems to represent nothing deeper than the realization that it is hard to carry water around in your pocket. And indeed, until recently, many archaeologists thought that the Neolithic Revolution was merely an adaptation aimed at making life easier. Climate change at the end of the last ice age, 10 to 12,000 years ago, resulted in the extinction of many large animals and altered the migration patterns of others. This, it was assumed, had put pressure on the human food supply. Some also speculated that the number of humans had finally grown to the point that hunting and gathering could no longer support the population. Settled life and the development of complex tools and other implements were, in this view, a reaction to these circumstances. But there are problems with this theory. For one, malnutrition and disease leave their signatures on bones and teeth. During the 1980s, however, research on skeletal remains from the period preceding the Neolithic Revolution revealed no such damage, which suggests that the people of that era were not suffering nutritional deprivation. In fact, the evidence suggests that the early farmers had more spinal issues, worse teeth, and more anemia and vitamin deficiencies, and died younger than the populations of human foragers who preceded them. What's more, the adoption of agriculture seems to have been gradual, not the result of any widespread climatic catastrophe. Besides, many of the first settlements showed no sign of having domesticated plants or animals. We tend to think of humanity's original foraging lifestyle as a harsh struggle for survival, like a reality show in which starving contestants live in the jungle and are driven to eat winged insects and bat guano. Wouldn't life be better if the foragers could get tools and seeds from Home Depot and plant rutabagas? Not necessarily. For based on studies of the few remaining hunters and gatherers who lived in untouched, unspoiled parts of Australia and Africa as late as the 1960s, it seems that the nomadic societies of thousands of years ago may have had a material plenty. Typically, nomadic life consists of settling temporarily and remaining in place until food resources within a convenient range of camp are exhausted. When that happens, the foragers move on. Since all possessions must be carried, Nomadic peoples value small goods over larger items, are content with few material goods, and in general have little sense of property or ownership. These aspects of nomadic culture made them appear poor and wanting to the Western anthropologists who first began to study them in the 19th century. But nomads do not, as a rule, face a daunting struggle for food, or more generally, to survive. In fact, studies of the San people, also called Bushmen, in Africa revealed that their food-gathering activities were more efficient than those of the farmers in pre-World War II Europe. And broader research on hunter-gatherer groups ranging from the 19th to the mid-20th centuries shows that the average nomad worked just 2 to 4 hours each day. Even in the scorched Dobe area of Africa, with a yearly rainfall of just 6 to 10 inches, food resources were found to be both varied and abundant. Primitive farming, by contrast, requires long hours of back-breaking work. Farmers must move stones and rock, clear brush, and break up hard land using only the most rudimentary of tools. Such considerations suggest that the old theories of the reason for human settlement don't tell the whole story. Instead, many now believe that the Neolithic Revolution was not, first and foremost, a revolution inspired by practical considerations, but rather a mental and cultural revolution fueled by the growth of human spirituality. That viewpoint is supported by perhaps the most startling archaeological discovery of modern times. A remarkable piece of evidence suggesting that the new human approach to nature didn't follow the development of a settled lifestyle, but rather preceded it. That discovery is a grand monument called Göbekli Tepe, Turkish for what it looked like before it was excavated, hill with a pot belly. Göbekli Tepe is located on the summit of a hill in what is now the Urfa province in southeastern Turkey. It is a magnificent structure, built 11,500 years ago, 7,000 years before the Great Pyramid, through the Herculean efforts not of Neolithic settlers, but of hunter-gatherers who hadn't yet abandoned the nomadic lifestyle. The most astounding thing about it, though, is the use